Accession number 19531, Reel 2.
Peter Betts, Reel 2. Now, once you arrived in the Arakan, can you tell me about the where you were and what kind of work you were expected to do, please?
Well, the mobile section which I joined had, I think, about half a dozen British officers. At least two, possibly more, American Nisei, who were non-commissioned officers in the army, and a supporting staff. We had transport of our own, and we had a kind of infrastructure, a small unit like that required, jeeps, lorries, cooks, orderlies, all the rest of it. When I arrived, which was in September, I was met by these two Welsh predecessors of mine who had been there much longer. They'd been out in the Caledon with the 81 division that previous campaigning season. And so they were there in a sort of friendly atmosphere and felt at home immediately. And then within about 4 weeks or so, all the other officers, because we were all officers by then, I should have mentioned we were commissioned in February back in Delhi, and commissioned directly as lieutenants, as it happened, which is rather odd. They were distributed between the formations constituting 15 Corps, 81 West African Div, 25 Indian Div, and 26 Indian Div. And my two Welshmen, for example, went off back to Caledon with 81 Div, because they got rather used to walking up and down the river by then. I and Dudley Sykes Thompson were the only people left at the center of the section. Now, what happened there was our particular working relationship was with the intelligence branch in Corps headquarters. The I branch, you know. And so there's a GSO1I, a colonel, and his staff, and they were the people with whom we were in constant in touch with the results of what we were getting out of the documents that were coming back. And at that time, it was pretty well all documents. It wasn't until, I suppose, about the end of 44 that we started getting prisoners at that time. And it was all operation-linked, of course. And that's when we started getting a few. But when I first arrived, it was entirely documentary stuff. And one would perhaps spend some time every day with the G3 and the intelligence branch and Corps headquarters going through what we'd got, what was coming through, and determining with them the location of activities and that sort of thing. A lot of patrol reports and so on had to be sort of linked up with it. So it was quite interesting. I enjoyed that. And it was sort of getting one's feeling involved.
Was it mainly trying to locate the enemy?
Well, the order of battle, of course, is the name of the game. Yes, who they were and where they were, really. And where they'd come from and where they were going to. Order of battle was really our principal objective. So we could locate and predict to a certain degree what was going to happen.
And how much in that late part of 1944 were you finding out from the document?
Well, I can't really remember the detail of that work, but one felt one was discovering things a lot of the time. One would suddenly come across some particular clue and dash off to the Corps headquarters with this new bit of information. There was a certain amount of quick reaction stuff at that time, but more than that I really can't remember.
What did you think of the work of these Nisei?
Well, they were very helpful in the sense that they could read cursive writing much better than I could. You probably know. I mean, the difference between printed characters and handwritten characters is enormous. And while I became able to read a certain amount of cursive handwriting, and of course, the quicker the chap wrote, the worse it was. The Nisei were very good from that point of view, and they were good at supplying our translations of things we weren't familiar with, but they were fairly hopeless at converting it into proper English. So we would work; they would work with me, and I would sort out what they had found and put it into intelligible English for our staff use.
What did their attitude towards the war seem to be?
The Nisei. Oh, they're a cheerful couple of sergeants. They were quite happy to be there. They knew they weren't going to be allowed to go forward of the section because the last thing we would allow to happen was for them to be taken by the Japanese. So they were sort of quite secure. And I think they quite enjoyed being in a foreign environment, such as India-Burma was to them.
So they didn't have any conflict of loyalty?
No, none at all, which is actually, in a way, surprising, because, as you know, many of the first generation Japanese in California, for example, were shoved into concentration camps, and their children, like these, were then allowed to join up. So most of them had bad memories of what had happened to their families. And I think you also probably know their farm has often been appropriated by white Americans once the Japanese had been pushed away. So it was a bad situation. But no Nisei ever was required to enter a combat unit against the Japanese. I mean, the only place that the combat Nisei operated was in Italy, a very well-known brigade in Italy made up of Japanese Nisei who cover themselves with glory there. But they weren't allowed to fight the Japanese at close quarters.
Did any of the Nisei reveal any sense of grievance to you about any particular thing?
No. I used to censor their letters, actually, and that was very sort of straightforward stuff. Do you think I could just take a break?
It does seem extraordinary that the Japanese army authorities were allowing their soldiers to produce their personal documents which could be of use.
Yes, I always found it extraordinary. As I say, in our services, keeping diaries was, almost a capital offence. But it seemed to be inherent in the Japanese attitude. I think, to some extent, it was a way of keeping in touch with what the world they'd left. They kind of wanted to have to trace the route they had followed from leaving home to where they actually ended up, and very much part of the ordinary soldier's diary was an account of where he'd been and what he'd done. So it was a remarkable source of information from that point of view. Although, as I'm sure you also know, there were various code words used for the units they all belonged to. And that, I suppose, introduced a mild difficulty in just identifying the units that they were with. But that was all codes, one became familiar with it in the end and was able to translate that all right.
What kind of code were
they? Well, for example, a Japanese unit would often carry the name of its commander. You would have, for example, Sakura Butai, which was a kind of composite brigade put together from remnants of other units and put under a chap called Sakura to carry out a number of operations, that sort of thing. We used to have the same thing, of course, in the British Army. You would have something like Hamilton Force or something, which was an ad hoc collection of units put under a guy called Hamilton to carry out certain operations, same sort of thing.
But did the diaries mostly consist of I went from A to B to C to D?
Yes. They did.
Anything more interesting than that?
Not. It was sometimes comment on how bad or good the food was, whether they were having any hostile activities they were involved in. But by and large, very much very basic geographical information.
And would you also capture photographs and more personal items of interest to you?
I don't remember photographs, actually, funnily enough, being captured. No, one used to get pieces of equipment, of course. I mean, rifles and revolvers would be sent back. Japanese flags would be sent back, which sometimes had interesting information on them in terms of names of people who had been carrying them, that sort of thing. But no, I don't remember photographs, funnily enough.
And were the documents mostly diaries, or were you getting other kinds of documents?
Well, we were getting other kinds of documents. I mean, army regulations, sometimes printed, sometimes handwritten, instructions of various kinds, manuals on how to use this or that piece of equipment. But the diaries were the main source of personal information.
Would you have official letters?
I can't remember, actually. I think we would have had operation orders or maintenance, you know, orders issued for administrative purposes, that sort of thing. But I don't remember at that time letters from one person to another, or even letters from home to the soldiers.
Did you get the impression that, apart from the diaries, the Japanese were careful or careless with their documents regarding falling into enemy hands?
Well, the very fact that diaries were a main item demonstrated that they were pretty careless from that point of view. But other than that, I wouldn't have any views.
I don't suppose you ever got movie film.
No.
At what stage did the prisoners start to come in?
Well, I think it must have been about the end of 44. I'm not very clear in my mind at the moment. I know that I was the only officer there alongside the CO at the end of 44. I went off on the operation which is described in the Nunnally book, the landing on Akiab on New Year's Day, 45. I think it must have been early 45 they started to come in.
Can you describe that landing at Akiab, please?
Well, I have described it at length in that book, but I will if you like. Yes, I was constantly keen to get out from the from Corps at down to unit level. My first endeavor was in about November, I think, of 44. I was posted to to West African Brigade in 82. That's the 82 West African Division was just coming in to the Arakan at that time, and 2 Brigade, which was Gold Coast Brigade, as it was then, Ghana, was just moving into the Calapanzin Valley between the coast and the Caladan, and taking over from one of the Indian divisions. And I was sent out to join brigade headquarters and to give whatever help they might require in both the language sense and also in a general sort of intelligence sense. So that was interesting. My first venture forward of Corps headquarters, which you know, sounds pretty banal looking back, but for me it was quite exciting at the time, getting into a jeep and going over the Nechadok Pass down to Tong Bazaar. It was all fairly forward, and the brigade headquarters was where I joined them, and they were in a sort of semi-fortified area of sit trenches and so on, and tents dug into the hillside and all that. It was an interesting time. First time I'd come across African troops, actually, which was quite a a sea change from the Indian Army, I must say.
In what sense?
Well, I never felt they were very martial, the Gold Coast people. They were sort of rather jolly, always laughing. They spoke this marvellous pidgin English, which one had to try and get used to. For example, an aeroplane was a lorry de for sky. And their disciplines were a little foreign to us. If some rich soldier committed some crime, the sergeant major was told to take him for bush. And he would get a strapping for a whip when he was taken that way, but which they preferred, actually, to having a pay docked, I think. But it was a sort of scene I wasn't familiar with, and it wasn't all that crazy about, I must say. They had British NCOs in the sort of posts that in the Indian Army were occupied by viceroys, commissioned officers, VCOs. And it was a sort of mixture that I found unfamiliar, anyway.
Why weren't you so keen on all this?
Well, I was glad to be there. I just didn't find them as I got used to the Indian soldiers at all. They're different people, less sophisticated, of course, in every way. Less sophisticated. I didn't think a great deal of the calibre of the British personnel, and indeed, I think you'll find Slim commented on that a year or two later.
Calibre in what sense?
Poor quality, British NCOs in particular. The sort of thing that often happened in the army, I'm sure you know, is of course often units would get rid of their worst people if they were required to supply them elsewhere rather than their best people. And that's why I think that sort of thing developed a bit. But I had no personal problem about that. The only exciting moment, I was there for about a month, I suppose, was when, I did two exciting things, I suppose. One was a rattle of gunfire in the middle of the morning when we were going about our business, which everyone sort of ducked the nearest slit trench. It turned out to have been an African soldier who had let off his Bren gun and managed to hit one of the staff officers who lost an eye as a result. And I never quite knew whether it was done on purpose or by accident, because later there were a number of cases reported when Africans tried to murder the British officers. I didn't know that at the time, but I've since found that. But anyway, that was one incident. And the other incident was when I decided I would really like to go up to one of the four battalions. I mean, just being there where I was, I felt still distance from the war. So I had a long and interesting trudge across a sea of elephant grass with a liaison officer up to the forward battalion, who actually were entrenched in very comfortable quarters, and hot tea was produced as soon as I arrived. It didn't seem like the war at all. And indeed, of course, there was all, in my view, there was always a tremendous caution about operations in the Arakan. One felt that we were far stronger. Our numbers of units were far greater than the Japanese had there. The British commanders were all scared stiff of the famous right hook. And there was a kind of slow degree of advance, which I thought at the time was rather overcautious. Later, I think I realized that Christensen, who was the corps commander, was not anxious to push the West Africans in too quickly, because they just arrived from Africa and they didn't really know what it was all about. So he was purposely tempering them slowly. But at the time, I felt impatient.
And then?
And then the next thing was when I was sent off to join the commander brigade, which was by that time had finally found its original function returning. They'd been used as infantry up in Assam, but at last, at the time had come, landing craft were available. They were able to start planning the combined operations down the coast of Arakan, which were designed to seize airfields from which the center could be supplied, the key to the central advance. So Achaeb was the first of these targets, and I went down and joined the commanders of Teknaf, a little peninsula north of Achaeb. And as I said in my previous contribution, it was quite interesting, really, I was the only non-commander in brigade headquarters, so I sort of felt a bit strange in a way, but they were good people, and since met them again. And we all, tremendous activity getting ready for what they'd all thought they were out there to do, which was actually carry out a landing. We then marched off down to the jetty, climbed onto this Royal Naval sloop, the Shoreham, and suddenly it was a different world. I mean, everything was clean and shining, and marvellously scrubbed decks and brass rails, and chaps in marvellously starched white uniforms. We was all very dusty and feeling rather sort of grubby, and being offered, you know, drinks on the quarter deck, and would you like any particular music played over the tenor? You know, have your requests, please. It was really quite amusing looking back on it. But the contrast was enormous. However, they're very good. I mean, the Navy was looked after as well. The officers turned out of their bunks that night so that we who were going to land the next day had a decent night's sleep. Actually, we didn't sleep at all, really, but it was a good gesture. And then fleet, as we might say, set sail, and the next morning we all roused and had to put on our kit and climb down the nets into the landing craft that were bobbing around. And it was also rather quiet. I, by that time, had expected, you know, there'd be bombardments and naval bombardments of the shore and aerial bombing and so on. Nothing. And it wasn't until we actually sort of halfway to shore that it was announced that the Japanese had gone anyway. And we were going to carry out the landing as if they were still there, as a training exercise. I don't think I've ever been so let down in my life. And anyway, we did, I had actually an Indian orderly with me who'd come from the section with me. Now I can't think of it. I wasn't on my own. A chap called Rick Aram. He'd been told to look after me. Well, looking back, it seems ridiculous. I was only, 20. I look at my grandsons of 20, and they haven't got their feet wet anyway. Anyway, we got off the landing craft, and commandos did their stuff and marched into the town, and I decided there wasn't much point of me staying, because there weren't any Japanese, and they hadn't left any documents, so I came back to Corps. Having been told by Barden, as my CEO, not to be away too long, because he was only on his own. So I had a rather brief experience of that commander landing. Later, the commanders went on down, and also 26 went down on further landings, Island of Ramri, and Chok Pu was the capital of that, and Kangor, number of quite stern battles were fought down that coast, but the Japanese still got away, unfortunately. However, the objective of gaining airfields was achieved, and so that was RAF moved in straight away, and the central advance was supplied all the way down. But my only other venture forward of Corps was I was sent down to 25 Indian Deer once at for a brief period at Mong Dor, because they had just discovered a platoon of Japanese where they hadn't expected them to be, and they had managed to not only get sort them up, but also capture a lot of documents. And they was sent an appeal back to Corps and send somebody down who can tell us if these are any good. So I went shooting off down there, and with my dictionaries, as well as my revolver, my haversack, and I think I managed to make a reasonable translation of the documents, which I obviously transmitted to divisional people, and then took back, and my niece went over them for me at core. And yes, it was all right. I got it pretty well right.
Were they very useful, in fact?
No, not really. They merely identified the unit, and really nothing very vital apart from that.
So this was well into 45, was it?
Well, that was about March 45, I suppose, yes. And then Corps headquarters had sort of drifted down the coast a bit from Cox's Bazaar. We had two or three moves. But then in May, of course, Rangoon had been taken from the sea, and 14th Army coming down the road as well. And 15 Corps was withdrawn to India. And we were withdrawn with it. And we went back up to the section as a whole, went back up to Calcutta and then back to Delhi, where it was sort of stood down, really, for the time being. And my next... And then for several months we were in Delhi, May till July, I suppose it was. And most of us went off and had leave, and then we sort of recouped ourselves a bit. And then at the end of July, I was posted to join 5th Indian Division in Rangoon, which was then preparing to take part in the Zipper. And oddly enough, it's an extraordinary coincidence that happened in the service. I found myself attached to 2nd First Punjab, which was the lead battalion going on that operation, part of 123 Brigade, which itself was part of 5 Indian Division. And as I arrived at 2nd First Punjab, at the officer's mess tent, out came three officers of 2nd First Punjab, who I'd actually spent some leave time in Simla with a few weeks beforehand, I suppose. So it was kind of like going home in a way. And so there was another preparation for a big operation. And then, of course, the bombs were dropped. And they were dropped before we'd actually started going anywhere. So there was a tremendous feeling of relief and exhilaration. And I think there was more... I had more gunfire over the camps in Rangoon, the sort of feu de joie, than I'd heard for many months before. It was an interesting time. But anyway, again, it was decided that we would then go not to join Zipper. Zipper was going to go on and do its stuff, landing on Morib, which you probably know, a disaster. Luckily, it wasn't defended. But we, 5DIV, and the 2nd First Punjab in particular, were directed down to Singapore. We were detached from the Zipper operation and sent down to reoccupy Singapore.
Were you the first troops into Singapore?
Yes, we were, yes. We'd had an advance party sent in by air, but we were the first troops actually to land from a ship and march up through the streets into the centre of the city. And I was the first British officer ashore, because I was with an Indian company commander and this company of 2nd First Punjab. So that was quite an experience. And funnily enough, looking back, we arrived at tremendous acclaim. I mean, the local population turned out in a thousand of great joy and welcome. When you think of what had happened when we abandoned Singapore in 1942, it was...